And joining us today is Steve Barry. Steve is the New York Times and number one internationally best-selling author of books such as The King's Deception, which is coming up. But he also has The Alexandra Link, The Venetian Betrayal, Charlemagne Pursuit, The Paris Vendetta. A lot of you may be familiar with especially The Third Secret and the Cotton Malone series and The Templar Legacy. Okay. And so these books are incredible. If you really like fiction and you love history, these are some great books. And this is a timely book, The Columbus Affair, because we learn some different things about Christopher Columbus. And if you don't mind, Steve, I'm going to go ahead and read what you wrote here on one of the first pages. It's Anonymous Observer, and it says, "For 500 years, historians have pondered the question, who was Christopher Columbus? The answer is simply another question. Who do you want him to be?"
That's right.
And again, who do you want him to be? And when that's the beauty of when you're reading a book, is that you're in your own world, you're in your imagination. You can make that character look whatever you want him to look like, sound whatever you want him to look like. Although I'm a big fan of audiobooks, and let me tell you that Scott Brick does an excellent job reading your books.
And thank you. I think so, too. I think he does a wonderful job.
Tell us a little bit about the Columbus Affair, because there have been a lot of controversies, especially lately. When I was growing up as a kid, we always remember, you know, it's Columbus Day. We learned about the three ships, the Nina, the Santa Maria, and the Pinta, you know, about in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But then all of a sudden, we started getting controversial things when, I guess, people said when we started going the wrong way, politically correctness. When political correctness came around, people said that that's when things started going haywire. And of course, that's their opinion and other people's opinion. But all of a sudden, Columbus is no longer the guy who we praise and worship because he discovered America. But all of a sudden, some people are saying he was not one of the great discoverers. And neither were any of the other ones, but he actually came over here and tortured and slaughtered the Native Americans or the natives who were living in whatever land he landed, because that's another controversy as well.
Yes, it is. I mean, the reality was he lived in a time. It was not a very learned time. And when they got over here, you know, they found these natives that had been here for thousands and thousands of years. And unfortunately, the cultures clashed. I mean, it was just they were not attuned enough to know how to deal with this meeting of the East and the West is what happened. You know, the old world, the new world came together. It actually, you know, met here, and it was quite traumatic. In Jamaica, for example, 150,000 local natives who had lived there were gone within 100 years of Columbus being there. It was a whole series of things that happened. Now, were they wholesale slaughtered? Yeah, there was killing. Sure, there was. And there was all kinds of things that happened. Disease accounted for most of it. It was reversed, by the way, both ways. The Europeans brought diseases over here like measles and things like that. But the natives from the Caribbean sent back venereal disease back to Europe. So it kind of went both ways. It was a clash of cultures that neither one of them were really ready for, and unfortunately the natives in the area had no chance. They had no chance to defeat it. So yes, there was this genocide that happened. There's no question that it did happen, and it was awful. And Columbus takes some of the brunt from that, but it's not all his fault. By a long shot, not all his fault, but he does take some responsibility. See, because Columbus didn't discover America. I mean, we know that he did not discover America. America had been discovered a million times before that. What Columbus did, though, is he put the New World on the map, and he opened up the route between old and new, and he made it a place that became, you know, part of human history. That's what he did. That's his contribution. Now, who he was is a whole other story, and that's what the novel deals with.
Steve, again, who he was raises some controversy, too, because, first of all, we talk about the old days, and what we mean by the old days, it could be as far, you know, it could be the Old West, it could be the Renaissance period, it could be the Dark Ages, you know, whatever the old times, everybody has a different perspective on the old times. But one of the things that we do know is as far as your book goes, is that Columbus basically had a word of honor with the queen and the king, and they promised him all these things and making him admiral of the oceans. And then all of a sudden, they're going, we didn't promise you anything.
Yeah, they lied to him. They basically cheated him is what they did, and it became a big controversy for him. He made a deal with them called the Capitulations of Santa Fe, and Columbus kept his end of it. He found the New World, and he did what he said he was going to do, but Ferdinand did not. And Columbus's daughter-in-law, after Columbus died, sued the king for a breach of the capitulations and ended up settling with the king by acquiring the island of Jamaica. She got total control of the island of Jamaica. And there's a reason why the Columbus family wanted Jamaica. This is all explored in the novel as well. There's a reason why they wanted to get control of that island. This raises the whole question about Columbus himself. You know, we know nothing about this man. We don't know where he was born, where he was raised, who his parents were. We don't even know his name. We don't know what he looked like. The portraits that have survived were not done during his lifetime. We don't know how he got to the New World because the map is gone. We don't know what happened when he got here because the journal that survived is a copy of a copy. We know nothing about him. And Columbus did this on purpose. He purposefully made his background a mystery because it's very possible and probable that Columbus had a secret he was guarding, and the secret was that he was Jewish. And the fact that he was Jewish mattered a lot in his day. It would have ended everything for him. But what I did is add a little twist to it so it still matters today. And that's where the thriller aspect of this book comes in.
Now, what you just mentioned about Columbus being a Jew is actually very factual, because we've heard stories. In fact, in my own family, with my last name being Sines, coming from Spain, and I've read some of my family history, that we come from a line of Sephardic Jews because we were forced to convert to Catholicism, or else, you know, we'd be in serious trouble. And is this basically what Columbus and some of his other fellow Jews did?
Yeah, what happened was is that, you know, the conversos, you were forced to convert to Christianity at that time in Spain because of what was going on there. The Ferdinand Isabella had thrown the Moors out. They had taken back control, so the Christians were back in control of the Iberian Peninsula. And so they began to ferret out all this. The church began to get control again, and the Inquisition was started at this time, and it was designed to ferret out false conversos, Jews who had converted but they really had not converted. And this is one reason why Columbus kept his background so secret. And the tale we hear all the time of Isabella sold her jewels so they could buy the ships and sail to America is simply false. It never happened. She didn't have anything to sell. The crown was basically broke at this time. The voyage to America was paid for by four conversos who were close to Ferdinand, one his closest advisor who was a Jew, and the four men got together and they paid for the voyage, which begs the question, why did they want Columbus to go to America? Well, there's actually a reason why, and this is what we explore in the novel.
One of the things that you mentioned about Columbus, and as far as, you know, the conversion and stuff like that, later on in the book, because we start off and we're back in Columbus Day, and then all of a sudden we're in modern day times, and we meet a journalist who, one of the worst things that could happen to a journalist is when somebody says that you've written something that's not true or that you've plagiarized. And that's very easy to do nowadays because of social media. You know, people will put stuff up and they'll copy and paste and not really cite anybody. So this is something that even if you're not a history buff, you can identify with this, people who have been, who are journalists, who are writers, who are in academia, etc., because of the plagiarism.
Yeah, it's Tom Sagan, my journalist in there, is set up. He's been destroyed by some people who want to take him out. And they set him up for an article that was falsified. And it is the worst sin that a journalist could commit, is that what they wrote is wrong, because a journalist is supposed to report fact, not fiction. And so I studied the case studies of about five or six fallen journalists who were actually accused of this and were had problems with this. So I studied sort of what happened to them and things that happened to them to get a feel for how it would play out. So I tried to keep it as accurate as I could.
What's interesting, though, is that this journalist that you're talking about, Mr. Sagan, and I don't want to give the whole story away, is the only person, or seems to be one of the key persons, who is going to help or can help one of your other protagonists, and that is Mr. Zachariah Simon.
Yeah, that's the whole point, is that, you know, Tom is, he's my protagonist of the story, and Tom is at the end of his rope. He's been destroyed. His whole career has been destroyed. He's ready to kill himself. He's going to kill himself. He's done. He just says, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I'm completely done. And at that moment, you know, Zachariah Simon appears and says, look, I have your daughter. I'm holding her hostage, and I need you to do something for me. Well, you know, what does Tom do? You know, the reality is Tom and his daughter hate each other. They've hated each other for years. The daughter despises him. He doesn't really care for her too much. He's reached a point where he's getting ready to kill himself. He has to make a choice. He has to make a decision of what to do. And, of course, he chooses to live, and that's how the story keeps going forward. But he has an interesting dilemma, you know, to go help this woman who basically hates his guts. And then he gets drawn into this whole secret. There's a huge secret that involves Tom's family that he never knew existed.
Steve, one of the controversies, and I'm not sure if you want to call it a controversy, but difficult things in being a writer, a researcher, whatever, and especially if you're writing historical fiction, is that even though it's fiction, there's that word historical there, and people are going to be watching you closely and say, wait a minute, this never really happened. So you have to be careful when you do your research.
Well, I do. I mean, mine is a modern-day thriller. It's an international suspense thriller that has a historical aspect to it. And so we have, you know, we deal with things from the past, but it's a modern-day thriller. I keep it about 90% accurate. I'm fairly good about keeping it that way. I trip it up just enough to keep the story moving along. But I put a writer's note in the back of my novel that tells you exactly where I did that and exactly where I was stayed true and where I deviated, so that you know what's real and what's not. That's how I kind of clear that up, so the reader is never fooled by any of that.
And that's what I liked about, because I heard the audio version, because I guess being in radio, I just love listening to audio. But you did that at the end. You explained specifically where you got all your information.
Yes.
And this helps people. And let's get back now to some of the other books that I mentioned, because they are all in a way, some sort of historical fiction, but they're all thrillers.
Yeah, well, I find something from the past, something lost, something forgotten, something that you may not know a lot about, but you want to know more about, and then I weave a modern day tale around it, like the Library of Alexandria, or the Tomb of Alexander the Great, or Charlemagne, or Napoleon. A clause in the United States Constitution that would shock most Americans to know it's there. I try to find something that will interest you, and I weave this tale. And in this particular story, it was Christopher Columbus.
Now, you, as far as getting people interested in your books, and you are very interested in getting people interested in history.
Yeah.
And you and your wife have an organization, do you not?
We do. We have a foundation called History Matters, and we raise money for historic preservation projects around the country. We just got back from a real swing through Kentucky and Tennessee, where we helped raise some money for some projects up in that area. And we go into a community, and we do pretty much whatever they need us to do. Most of the time, we'll teach a writer's workshop, a workshop that deals with the craft of writing. It's about a four-hour workshop. You buy your way in with a contribution, and all of that money goes to the historic project. No, we don't charge to come, and we don't charge expenses or anything like that. We donate our time to do it. And we've raised a little over $300,000 for various historical projects around the country.
And do you have a list, or specifically, how do you choose what you're going to target?
People send us requests. You can do that. You can go to my website, steveberry.org, and you can send me, click on the History Matters the icon and send us an email, and we get an email, and we just take a look at it, and if we can work it in, we do it. We try to accommodate as many as we can. We do about 6 to 8 a year, so we look at them very carefully and decide where the trip is, where we can, you know, get out that way. If we can't do it this year, we'll try to do it next year. So anybody out there who has a project, I encourage them to send us an email.
I'm not going to compare your book to any other book or to any writers, but some people who have read your books have told me that most of the books, or at least this book specifically, is similar to Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code.
Well, it's similar in that Dan writes international suspense thrillers too. That's what I write. I write in that genre. That genre is action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings. That's, you know, that's what that genre is, and that's the elements of that genre. So yes, we write similarly because we write in that genre. But so does Clive Cussler. There's a whole bunch of writers that write in that genre. And now our stories are very different. We have some very different stories. But as far as action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings, yes, those are very similar.
Now, some authors like Robin Cook, Tess Garrison, Clive Cussler, as you mentioned, yourself, they come up with a novel and they introduce some characters, and then all of a sudden, I guess because the reader likes those characters, all of a sudden you begin a series with those actors. Protagonist characters, and you did that with Cotton.
I did. I created Cotton in the Templar Legacy. And I had no idea if anybody would ever want to read another story with him. I'd like to for it to be a series. I was hoping it would become a series, but I didn't know it was going to become one. So you write the book and you hope, and sure enough, Cotton was very popular, and so he came back, and he's had 7 adventures now, Cotton has. And now he took this year off. That's why this standalone, The Columbus Affair, is a standalone, where I created a new set of characters and within Cotton's world, but a new set of characters. So Cotton took the year off. Cotton will be back though next year. He just took 1 year of a vacation.
But when we talk about standalone and maybe a series, this doesn't mean that someone can pick up one of your other books and be lost, completely lost.
Not at all. In fact, I write them specifically so that would never happen. I actually have people who have read my series backwards. They started with the most recent one and read back to the Templar Legacy, and it's no problem. I write them that way on purpose. If you read them in order, there's a few things here and there you'd recognize, just a precious few. If you read them backwards, you would never notice that those things were there. I try to make sure that each book is as independent as possible, though they do fit into a series. They still stand as independent stories. You can pick them up in the middle. You can go however you want.
I have an article here that says that recently you spoke I can't remember the name of the city, but the topic was determination.
Yes, I've done that talk quite a bit around the country.
Okay.
And that's because of my personal story. You know, from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word was 12 years.
Wow.
It was a very long process. I wrote 8 manuscripts during that time. 5 were submitted to New York publishing houses. They were rejected a total of 85 times. So I hung in there until the 86th time when I finally made it in the 12th year of writing. So I tell people all the time, I may not know a lot about success, but I'm a world-class expert on rejection. I understand that very well, and I can deal with it pretty good. So I talk about that a lot, particularly to writers' groups and to other groups. I talk about, don't tell me you can't do it, because I'm living proof it can be done.
Do you have a say-so as far as what topics or what you want to write about?
Sure. But the contract specifies, it would say 3 international suspense thrillers. In my case, it might say 3 Cotton Malone books, but I don't think they specify that because we can vary off of that. I think it just basically says 3 international suspense thrillers. And, you know, it's between me and my publisher to determine, you know, what those subject matters will be about. My publisher is very intricately involved in all that as far as who the characters will be, what the title will be, where it will be set. All of that is predetermined before I start writing.
As you mentioned earlier, the publishing business has become very complicated, and I would imagine that over the last few years it has become even more complicated because of the Kindles, the Nooks, and the fact that there's self-publishing, so a lot of people are self-publishing books. And so that has thrown in another wrench in the fire, whatever you call it. Yes. And so that makes it difficult. But there's also, because people are so busy, there are audiobooks. And in your case, how do you select a voice for your book? Because, I mean, your book can be the best book written, but if it's not read right, if it's not the right voice, it can turn people off.
Yeah, it does. And my favorite reader, Scott Brick, I mean, he was my favorite. So when they asked me, who would you like to read your books, I immediately said, Scott. He's done all of my books except Romanoff Prophecy, Third Secret, and Templar. Those are the only three that he has not done. Those were done prior to him coming on board. So, but other than all the others, he has done the audios on them, and I love the way he does it. I listen to him myself because I want to hear how he says the foreign words, and I want to see how he puts it together. I very much enjoy listening to him.
And how did you come about listening to him?
Because I used to listen to audiobooks all the time. See, when I practiced law, our courthouse was 22 miles away. So when I would drive back and forth to court, which I would do many times a week, I would listen to books in the car. That was my thing. I listened to, two, three audiobooks a month I would listen to. I listened to a lot of audiobooks back in those days. And I remember Scott. I mean, he was great. I loved it. When Scott was doing a book, I enjoyed it. I didn't want it to end. So when I got a chance to pick a narrator, I said, I want him.
And he does Clive Cussler as well, right?
He does. I think he does do Clive's. Yes, he does. He does a lot. He's the number one audiobook narrator in the business.
Now, tell us a little bit about what you're doing with USO and the soldiers.
Well, what we did with that was really great. I got to be a part of the first contingent of thriller writers who went over to Iraq. And they've never sent a group of writers over there before all together. And so there was five of us, myself, Doug Preston, David Morrell, Andy Harp, and Jim Rollins. And we went over part of Operation Thriller. We did that 2 years ago. And we were the first contingent to do it. We were the guinea pigs to see if it would work. It was extremely successful. The troops loved it. So they did Operation Thriller 2 last year, and they're doing Operation Thriller 3 this year. I think it'll become almost a yearly thing now. And then I've branched out from that, and I've done some other stuff since then. I just got back from Fort Knox, where I was at the Wounded Warrior Transition Unit, and I spent some time with the Wounded Warriors there last week. We did some a talk, and we gave away books, and we visited with them for a day.
As far as visiting the wounded warriors, that must be difficult because you walk in there and you want to keep a straight face, you want to show your sympathy and your empathy, but at the same time you know that these guys and ladies have been through some terrible things.
Yeah, and the last thing in the world they want you to do is feel sorry for them. In fact, you can't feel sorry for them. They will not
exactly.
Allow it. Well, they're too good. They're too upbeat. I mean, you never hear a negative word. You don't ever hear that. You don't ever hear any of that. I was at Bethesda and Walter Reed as part of the USO tour, which is more powerful because these are guys who were on the battlefield a few days earlier, and they're sitting there, and you never hear a negative word. You never hear anything but positivity. They're very upbeat. They will not allow any negativity, and so they want that. They want you to be there with them and to stand with them, but you're not there to feel sorry for them at all. They're said, nope, I made my choice. I fought, got hurt. Okay, let's move on.
And most of us, as you mentioned, because we interviewed Shoshana Johnson, which she was taken as a POW during Iraqi Freedom, and we told her thank you, and she said, I didn't do anything. I was just doing my job.
Right. That's what they all said. And they all, by the way, all want to go back and continue to do their job is what they want to do. So they're an incredible group of people, and you get very motivated by being around them. It's quite remarkable. And so we've done several things with them, and we'll continue to do that.
Now, as far as just for your information, I want to let you know that because I do have friends in the military and who have been deployed, and I'm a big fan of audiobooks. In fact, I listen to 3 or 4 a week, and I have sent them over to the soldiers, and they're so thankful because, they don't always have time to sit down and relax. But when you're listening to the audio, and especially if you have someone like Steve Brick, it's almost like someone's reading a story to you, and then with the sound effects, the music, everything else, you are there.
It's really cool, and reading is the number one recreational activity over there. It was when we were there. a lot of books over there, a lot of things over there. So reading is a big deal over there. Books are a big deal. And I was very surprised to see, you know, the amount of books that there were over there is a lot. And so, you know, having writers over there, they were just thrilled. And so it's a great thing. I mean, as I said, I'm part of International Thriller Writers, which is a group of 2,000 thriller writers from around the world. And these operations that the USO are doing, we draw from our ranks to send over there. So I look for this to be a yearly thing now.
I mentioned audiobooks, Steve. One thing that I did not ask you about is how do you feel personally as e-books or Kindle books or Nooks?
Oh, they're wonderful. I mean, the e-revolution happened in 08, 09, and 010, and the e-revolution is over, and the e-book won, and it's done. And so the ebook is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. It's just going to grow. It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. In my genre right now, it accounts for about 70% of my sales are ebook. 30% are actual physical books. That's roughly what most thriller writers have, somewhere in that neighborhood. So 60-40, 70-30 in that neighborhood is what it is. We live at a very exciting time. We live at the moment in human history when the primary way that information will be conveyed has shifted from words on a page to ones and zeros on a screen. And it's shifting that way. Now, are books going anywhere? No. We're still going to have books. Not going anywhere. Will there be less of them? Yes. No question. And as time goes on, the delivery system will shift more and more towards the E. And you're going to get more and more of that delivery system. And we happen to live at that moment when that happens. It'd be kind of like living at the moment when they went from clay tablets to papyri. And they went from papyri to parchment and parchment to paper. If you happen to live at that moment when it happens, it's a little confusing, you know, to do. And you have to get used to the shift, and that's where we are right now.
President John Adams always said, you're never alone with a poet in your pocket. And I just can't picture him carrying a Kindle in his pocket.
Well, if he lived in the 21st century, he probably would embrace it and to do it. As I said, books are not going anywhere. They're still here. They're fine. They're not going anywhere. Only a tiny fraction of the billions of books that exist are digitized. So they're not going anywhere. But over the next 10, 15, 20 years, the primary delivery system of information is going to shift from paper to electronic.
Steve, if people want to find out more about your books and everything that we've talked about this morning, perhaps we missed something, what is your webpage?
SteveBerry.org. It has everything on there, all the books, what's coming out next year. As you mentioned earlier, The King's Deception, Cotton Malone's next adventure, will come May 7th of next year, 2013. It's a great adventure. Cotton's coming back. He's going to deal with a legend in England that I stumbled across, a fascinating legend that may well be true. And so that's coming out. You can find out about that. You can find out about all the books, the USO tour, everything is at steveberry.org. And any of our upcoming History Matters events are on there as well.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. We appreciate that very much.
Appreciate you having me.
We've been visiting with Steve Berry, and Steve is an internationally acclaimed author, New York Times, and number one internationally best-selling author. His newest book is Steve Berry's The Columbus Affair, and it's out just in time for Columbus Day. And you're going to find that there are a lot of twists and turns in this book, and it's an incredible book. He has a lot of other books that you can see on his webpage, steveberry.com. Again, we've been visiting with Steve Berry, the author, and the name of the book is The Columbus Affair. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you, sir.